It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome to Money for Lunch. It's good to have you here. It's, what is today? Tuesday, June 28th. And you know what? It's going to be a fantastic show. Great lineup. We have Kwame Christian. He is a lawyer. And we're going to be talking about negotiations. It's a fantastic skill to have. Jane Bryant Quinn joining us today, talking about you and your money, the indispensable retirement guide. Man, that's important. And then a new contributor on the show, Lupe Rebecca Samaniego. She's a psychologist, certified high performance coach, and she'll be joining us today as well. So let me tell you, it's a strong, strong show, and I'm excited. I'm excited for you guys because we really strive to bring you really the best from all over, from not just business, but science and politics and health, and really try to bring you a rounded education, if you will. And so it's always fun to bring you these shows. And I appreciate the fact that you guys support us and promote us and all that good stuff. So thank you so much. And you can connect with me on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Just look up Bert Martinez and love to connect with you there. My first guest today, Kwame Christian, a lawyer that focuses on serving the needs of small businesses. He also started a consulting firm that specializes in teaching entrepreneurs and professionals how to negotiate in the business world, and is regularly invited to speak on topics on the topic. Kwame also hosts a podcast called Negotiation for Entrepreneurs, where he interviews successful entrepreneurs and shares powerful persuasion techniques. After only 2 months, the show has been downloaded almost 2,000 times from listeners in 6 different continents and has been featured on iTunes, new and noteworthy. And guess what? Not everybody gets on new and noteworthy list. So that's a big deal. Kwame Christian, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Bert.
You bet, man. So let's talk about this. First of all, why is negotiation an important skill in the business world?
Oh, negotiation is crucial. The thing that's really powerful about negotiation is that it's one of the only business skills that we utilize every day. And for me, the definition of negotiation is, I keep it very broad. I say any communication you have with another person where one or more of the participants want something, that's a negotiation. So when we're in the business Ooh. World, we're negotiating. When we come back home, we're negotiating. Just different places, different contexts, but it's utilizing the same skill.
Yeah, and I like that. I like the fact that you're saying anytime you're interacting or communicating with somebody that wants something, it's a negotiation. That changes the dynamic every time you're interacting with that person. It changes the focus.
Exactly. To think of it this way, you know, when imagine when you got a new car, something you notice is that once you get that car, you start to see that same car everywhere on the street. You know, you just become very aware of its presence, so you notice it more often. And once you start to get into negotiation and start to hone your skills, that's how it's going to be. You're going to see those opportunities to get more value for in your personal life and your business life every day more often.
Yes, that's amazing. That's amazing. You know what? So let's talk about this because, you know, there's a lot of different thoughts out there about negotiation, what makes a good or a bad negotiation. So what's your take? What are some of the most important characteristics of a good negotiator?
Okay, so I'll give you my top three. My top three are curiosity, creativity, and confidence. So with curiosity, one bad rap people get when they think about negotiation, one misunderstanding they have about good negotiators is that they think of people who give really good arguments. That might be a good debater or a good lawyer, but maybe not a good negotiator. Good negotiators ask more questions than they spend more time asking questions than they do speaking. So when I negotiate, I try to keep the breakdown of communication 70-30, where I'm speaking 30% of the time, the other person speaking 70% of the time. And that's usually a good signal that I'm asking the right questions. So curiosity is key, because it's like the old saying, knowledge is power. And when you go into any negotiation, your number one goal is to gather as much information as possible. So curiosity is going to be critical, a critical skill, if you want to become a better negotiator. The next thing is creativity. So a lot of times we see negotiations as a zero-sum game. Maybe we're arguing about one thing. For example, the classic example is, imagine two children fighting over the last orange in the house, a brother and a sister. And so the brother says he wants it, the sister says she wants it. So they go to the mother. What's the mother going to do? She cuts it in half, of course. So the brother peels the orange, throws the rind away, and eats the fruit. And the sister, instead, she peels the orange, throws away the fruit, and uses the rind for a cake. So that is a good example of both. If they took the time to ask why the other person wanted the orange, they could have gotten everything that they wanted. So that's curiosity. And then creativity, because they're thinking about it in a zero-sum kind of situation, they weren't able to think outside the box and get more of what they wanted. And then the last one, confidence. You know, the first step in any negotiation is the ask. And that's usually where people fail, because they don't make that ask because they're afraid of offending people or whatnot. And so one of my favorite sayings is competence breeds confidence. So the more time you spend learning this skill, the more confident you're going to be and the more willing you're going to be to take that step and make that ask and become a better negotiator.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You know, and something that's interesting too, when you look at the way the U.S. negotiates versus the way, let's say, foreign dignitaries negotiate, it's really different. I think that, you know, from what I've seen, I'd like to get your feedback on this. From what I've seen, as Americans, we like to negotiate to a point, meaning I'm going to negotiate with you, but I want to get it done within, let's say, an hour. And
right.
It seems like a lot of our foreign allies or foreign, let's say, business people or something like that, sometimes these guys are ready to negotiate for days. So where, you know, it's a completely different mindset about negotiation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's where curiosity comes in too, because if you're more curious and interested in learning about the culture of the person that you're talking to, you're going to gather that information. Oh, let's say, for example, just the generalized stereotypes of the different cultures. So Asian cultures, specifically Japan, they like to take more time with their negotiation. Just like you said, take multiple days to really get to know you and create a relationship between the parties. And so if you, as an American, even though we're more transactional, we're just more get to the table, get it done, and get out, if we take the time and we're curious and we learn about the way that their culture handles negotiation, we're going to be a lot more flexible when it comes to negotiating with people of that culture. So that's another key another quality of a great negotiator. They take the time and understand the other person, and they're flexible and they're able to kind of play on that different level in order to get the success that they're looking for.
I love it. I love it, man. And it's just interesting too. And I like this idea of curiosity, because sometimes we think that the person really wants the orange like I do, but that's really not their intent.
Exactly. Exactly. And the way I describe it is shift your focus from what to why. So we always focus on what people are asking for, but we don't think about why they're asking for it. So going back to that orange example, people would ask, the children are just focused on the what. The what is the entire orange, but they need to ask why. And so let's take it to a business situation. A lot of times people might be, they might have certain concerns with contracts. And so they might be very focused on maybe getting a certain timeline. They need products at a certain time. It's like, so you have to understand like what their biggest issue is. So if time is their biggest issue, maybe they don't need to have it written in the contract in a way that your team would object to, but maybe you could give personal
right.
guarantees in other ways, just trying to be as flexible to get the deal done. But you need to understand why people are making the claims that they're making in order to do that.
Yeah, and I think that, what do you call it? I just want to focus on this because sometimes, again, we assume that they want what we want for the same reasons, and this is a mistake. And so I like this idea of curiosity. So let's talk about this. What kind of things mm-hmm. are negotiable, in your opinion?
Really, that just depends on your how much negotiation you're willing to handle. Because in my opinion, I see everything as negotiable. You know, so anytime somebody gives you a price for something, of course, a lot of times they factor in overhead, they factor in the cost, labor costs, those type of things. But when it comes to margin, to a certain extent, people just make that number up. You know, that's the kind of, that's this fluff, the margin, that's how much I'd like to make in a perfect world. But a lot
right.
of times, they're more interested in making a sale, though. So they'd be willing to be flexible on that margin in order to make that sale. So here's an example. So I was helping a client a couple of weeks ago, and she was moving her business to a new location. And it was going to take her some time to get the same kind of foot traffic and recognition for that new location. And so she was concerned about the expenses up front. And so the rent was pretty high, but I talked to the landlord, and I was able to get her free rent for the rest of the year, 6 months. But we were able to, in return for a higher rent, afterwards, subsequently for the rest of the remainder of the lease. So that accomplished my goal of making sure that my client is fiscally secure for the most critical points of her tenancy, but it also satisfies the landlord's goal to still make a good amount of money over the duration of the tenancy. So yeah, thanks. Yeah, and actually on that point, I have this freebie I'd like to offer to your listeners too. I created this list of things that are negotiable, business and personal expenses that are negotiable. So if they go to my website, AmericanNegotiationInstitute.com/list, they can download a free list of things that are negotiable, and they can try and start saving some money for their business.
I love it. AmericanNegotiationInstitute.com/list/list, and you can get the link there. And you know what? And I think that it's true. I think everything can be negotiated. I did an experiment many years ago. It was a business class I was taking, and so the assignment was to go out and negotiate everything for the day. And so it was really good because, like, you know, we went to a Walgreens and they would not negotiate, but we tried, right? And we tried to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things where I still believe that if you go to the, you know, I was talking to a clerk. If I would have talked to a manager, I probably would have gotten better results. But we were on a time
mm-hmm.
frame. So, you know, it was one of those deals. But I think that what's interesting to me, and this is I think that this is something that happens to all of us. You know, when we're broke, I think when we're broke or when we're really tight on budget, we become better negotiators because we really got to make our budget work. So we negotiate everything. We ask for a discount.
Right.
You know, we'll tell people, listen, I don't have that budget. Is there anything we can work out? Right. But then when we
mm-hmm.
start becoming successful and we have the money, we forget to negotiate.
Right. Right.
And it's really a skill that if you are making $1 million a year, or let me rephrase it, if you're spending $1 million a year or even $100,000 a year and you negotiated 10%, that's, you know, that's 10 grand in your pocket or 100 grand in your pocket, depending on how much you're spending. 10%, you know, is a lot. You cannot get 10% from the bank. And so
right.
you know, so if all of a sudden you saved an extra $5,000 or $10,000, that, you know, to show you the power of that, at least the way I think, you know, right now when banks are paying 2% and 3% interest rate, think about it. If you were to have $100,000 in the bank earning whatever 2.5%, you know, that's going to make you $5,000 a year, I think. Maybe $2,500 a year. So maybe $200,000 will make you $5,000. So if you're making $50,000 a year and you're able to save $5,000, that's the equivalent of having $200,000 in the bank in today's interest from a bank or something like that. But bottom line is save that $5,000, that $10,000, that $7,000, whatever it is, and you can use it for investments, for retirement, for vacation. It's, you can make a game out of it.
Absolutely, and I'm really glad you picked this up, because the investment in the negotiation skills is one of the best investments you can make for your life going forward. And think about the savings, like you said, $5,000-$10,000 a year that you could save. That's not even counting the offensive uses of negotiation. So you're saving $5,000-$10,000. What if you get $5,000 or $10,000 in addition on those contracts that you're working, or $5,000 or $10,000 in your salary negotiations? And so now it's a net of $10,000 to $20,000 every year. And
yes,
then it compounds. You do that every year going forward. And then if you do that during like the duration of your child's childhood, you pay for school. You know, and you didn't
change anything specific in your business. Not only do you pay for their school, you pay for a really good school, possibly a school and a car. I mean, it's great. Kwame, we're out of time, but I would love to bring you back and talk more about the power of negotiation. For you guys who want to follow Kwame and find out more about what he does, you can go to AmericanNegotiationInstitute.com. If you go /list, you get a freebie there. Kwame, Christian, thank you so much for stopping by.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Good stuff there. Great stuff. Really to enhance, you know, really all aspects of your life. It's a great skill set. And we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, folks, we're back. My next guest, Jane Bryant Quinn. Jane Bryant Quinn is leading commentator on personal finance. Her new book is How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. She's the author of the best-selling Making the Most of Your Money Now, Smart and Simple Financial Strategies for Busy People, and Everyone's Money Book. Her personal finance column currently appears in AARP Bulletin, and you can find her online at janebryantquinn.com. Jane Bryant Quinn, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hello, Bert. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, you know what? I think this is such an important subject matter. And, you know, and it's funny, too, because, you know, retirement is, I think, a lot like our health. You know, when you're young, you're not really thinking about it. But as you start getting older, your retirement becomes more and more important to you.
I think it suddenly starts clicking in. Maybe your late 40s, you suddenly look around and say, actually, what have I done here? How much am I saving? And if you are one of the lucky people that works for a company that has a 401k plan and you've put in the max and your employer is automatically putting money into an account for you and you're investing it in stock mutual funds, you're probably in pretty good shape. But if you are someone who has his or her own business, you work in the gig economy, you're an entrepreneur, and you have nobody to do that automatic saving for you, then these are the people who are having more trouble, because you know, to find the money, to get the discipline to do it when it's not being done for you is hard.
Yes, yes. It is. I think that a lot of people in the financial world really forget how difficult it is to, you know, to master savings. I mean, first of all, it's not something that we're taught enough about, and we don't have enough. I guess the word is I'm looking for is motivation. We don't have enough motivation. We're not taught about it. It's not urgent. And so, you know, I think that the statistics is that the average American saves like 2%.
Well, yeah, they save about maybe 5%. And then when you hit your 50s, you're saving the average is 9%. And so, and you know, that's not necessarily a lot of money. And one thing you need to think about is longevity. You know, everybody kind of forgets how long we're living these days. And, you know, late 40s or early 50s, especially if you're a business owner or you're working on your own, you start looking ahead and say, wait a minute, I'm likely, you know, at 50, the odds are pretty high that you're going to live until your late 80s. I mean, you've got another 40 years to live. And how are you going to fund that? And this is a thing that suddenly comes upon you, because when you hit that time, you have a certain amount of money. You've saved it. It's in the value of your business that you can sell. It's in your Social Security. It's whatever you have, you have. And no magic wand is going to come down and all of a sudden make more for you. So at that point, you're going to have to figure out how to live on what you have. Because your paycheck will stop. And so when you're younger and you're looking forward, that's something that's a way you need to think about it. And there are ways you can automate your savings when you're younger, if you're not lucky enough to be working for a company that does it for you. If the company does it for you, put in the maximum, because then you will actually be okay without any effort.
Yes. And I think that you know, those are some of the key elements that a lot of people just don't get. I mean, could you imagine getting free money? So whatever it is, you know, I know that everybody's different, but if your employer is matching money, oh my gosh, and you're not taking advantage of that, you really don't understand what's going on. You know, the other thing that you said there is about us living longer. I mean, I think, goodness, you know, when Social Security was first created, I read this a while back, the average person was living to 65. I mean, they didn't want you to actually collect on that money, you know, and so it was very common for somebody to retire and die shortly thereafter. And but like you said, now we're living to 80, 90. You know, years ago, when I say years ago, just a short 20 years ago, having somebody live to 100 years of age was unheard of. Now it's gotten to be commonplace. It's not even a big shock anymore.
Bert, we just celebrated my mother's 101st birthday, and 4 years ago when she was 97, she married a lovely young man of 84, and they are both in sharp and in reasonably good health. And so that gives you some sense of what is going on today. But the key thing and the thing that I wrote about is that how to make your money last. The issue is that whatever you have managed to save, and if you're an entrepreneur, you're in a small business, there's a solo 401k that where you can actually put in a lot of money, a lot more than you could put into an individual retirement account, or there's a SEP IRA. I mean, there are things that you can do that you can set up with a mutual fund company or a bank and have money go into it automatically. But then at a certain point, you say, okay, this is what I've got. how do I figure out how to make this money last for the rest of my life? And there are answers in terms of how much you can withdraw from your savings and have it last for 30 or 40 years, whether you should buy an annuity, which more financial planners are suggesting these days, waiting before you take your Social Security. You know, if you take Social Security at 70 instead of 62, your check is going to be 76% higher than if you had started it young. And so, you know, especially if you're a business owner, there's no reason to retire early as long as you're in good health. You keep working and you put off taking Social Security. So there are lots of things you can do, but starting to power up your savings with these great tax-deferred savings plans when you're young, which I also wrote about in the book, these are the kinds of ways to get yourself started and to make it automatic. If it's automatic, you'll make it. And if it's not automatic, it's going to be harder for you.
Yes. I hope everybody gets that. I love that. Set it up so it's automatic. The other thing that people need to be aware of, and this happened to a lot of people in 2007, 2008. This happened personally to my father-in-law. He was the bank president of this regional bank, and this regional bank had an amazing history. It had survived the Depression. It was over 120 years old, all that great stuff. But after he retired, and half of his retirement was the pension that he's getting from the bank. And unbeknownst to him, something that he didn't plan for is that after he retired, one of the bank officers started embezzling from the bank. And here's a bank that had withstood everything, had withstood 120 years of ups and downs, finally had to close its door. His pension is gone. So that's something else that we all have to be aware of. That crap happens. So even though you've done everything right and you're good and you're honest and you've done everything right and you're a perfect human being, crap happens that we sometimes can't be prepared for.
Crap happens, and then whatever I'm sure what your father-in-law did was take a look at what he had and then figured out how he was going to live on it, because crap happens, yeah. And we still live to be 100 years old, and one way or another you figure it out. But one thing to do, of course, is to try to save that money outside a company too. So if you can do that in a separate plan that is not tied to a company, then that's something that you're going to control. So I always hope people will be big savers, and so as well as automatically saving through a company plan if you have one, to automatically save in a mutual fund, and I'm a big believer in stock market index mutual funds. If you save in these, then it is not under a company control, and so you've got another pot of money out there, and I think that's very valuable to have. But the pensions, you know, things happen. You know, people get divorced, people get sick, all kinds of things happen, and what you do, I call it right-sizing your life. Whenever you retire or your paycheck stops or something bad happens or you just retire, whatever it is, at that point what you do is say, how much income do I have from Social Security, pension if I still have it, taking, say, 4% of the amount I've saved and using that every year, how much income do I have? And then right-sizing your life means you figure out how to live on that kind of income, and that's the way that's the way people approach it. You know, it can be a hard life if it doesn't go well, but if it does go well and you've got that money saved, the problem is trying to live higher than you have saved the money for, and that's what you really have to think about. I guess that was my biggest motivation. You know, can I keep on living the way I'm living?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that I've learned, and it's something I also learned from my father-in-law, is that, you know, there is the adage, live below your means. And I think that needs to be changed a little bit, especially when you retire. You need to live way below your means. The fact that my father-in-law was frugal, he was able to withstand losing half of his retirement. if he would have, you know, he had his home paid for. He had, as you said, retirement investment in other areas.
Mutual funds, index fund. So he had another source of money.
That's right. And again, he's frugal. He was able to withstand that, even though it hurt tremendously, he was able to withstand it. My point being is that a lot of us, you know, again, you have to look at the reality is, and the reality is you may live, as you said, another 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Do you need the house that you're in, or can you sell it and maybe downsize to a condominium or maybe a smaller house? Living well below your means allows you to have that flexibility when life happens.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I love the idea of getting a paid-up house by the time you retire. It is
yes.
possible to do. That was one of my goals, certainly, and I did it. And so some people say, oh, I can make more money by keeping it in the stock market, and that's probably true over the long term. On the other hand, as you get closer and closer to thinking about retirement and looking at the bills that come in, it's really nice not to have a mortgage to pay. That gives you a tremendous amount of flexibility when you are looking at that. So, you know, looking. The other thing is that I find a lot of people, as they approach retirement, they think, now I need income investments, and I'm going to go out and invest in bonds and this and that. I mean, excuse me, what income do you get from bonds these days? And if you're 55, if you're 60, again, you are a long-term investor still. You're going to live another 30 years. And that means you should still be pretty heavily dependent on stocks. And people don't think about that, especially after the crash that took your father-in-law's pension, the 07, 08. People say, I don't want to be in stocks. Long-term investing still works over 15, 30-year periods. The U.S. economy is going to grow. Global economy is going to grow. I don't care about Brexit. It's not going to be good now, but it's going to be good in, you know, 10, 15 years. And you're a long-term investor, even as you approach retirement, and you should think about it that way.
Absolutely. I love that advice. That is absolutely the way to think about it. The reality is, as you said, is that over the long term, it is going up. It will continue to go up. The situation is this. Look, if you look at it historically, the markets all crash sooner or later. There's going to be a bubble. It's going to crash. It's going to correct, whatever terminology you want to use. The difference is being able to get out of it, so maybe you don't get hurt or don't get hurt very much, and then being able to take advantage of those drastic changes. So, you know, bottom line is, if you were sitting on a mound of money when 2007 happened or 2008 happened, you could have probably bought some great stocks at a premium discounted price. You could have bought some, maybe a house or two, or maybe even gotten into an apartment complex much cheaper than you would have today. And I know a buddy of mine, that's exactly what he did. It wasn't in 2007, but it was, 20 years earlier when the market corrected. He got, he quit his job because he had saved a bunch of money, and he started buying apartment complexes because, again, the bottom had dropped out, and he was buying these apartment complexes that normally he would not have been able to afford. He got smoking deals out of it because he had cash, and he bought two or three of them. And as the market turned up, he was able to sell one, and then he still lives on the other two. And bottom line is, it was something that he had not ever done before. He had kind of studied it out. He got some help and all this other stuff. I'm not going to say that, you can't really take shortcuts when you're kind of investing these kind of big monies, but bottom line is being prepared. And if you're liquid enough, you could double or triple your ROI by taking advantage of these down markets that are going to happen.
Yeah, one thing about the real estate business, of course, is that I always warn people that's like starting your own small business. It's not like investing in stocks, which you can do, or I don't buy individual stocks. I'll put it that way. I don't think people are smart enough to buy individual stocks and do well over time. But if you invest in an index fund that rises and falls with the market as a whole, you're going to do a whole lot better than the stock pickers do. So actually, that's the way I invest. But you can, that's passive investing that you can do while you're doing your other job. Whereas if you're going to be a real estate investor, that's something where you need a lot of special knowledge, and you need about financing and cap rates and negotiation, as you had with your previous guest, and all these other sorts of things. So real estate is a separate thing where people, I think, need a tremendous amount of information in order to
begin training
to invest. Whereas when we're talking about the stock market, if you stay away from the idea that you're going to always have these fabulous individual stocks that are always going to beat the market, because that's not going to happen. That never happens. All the data shows that doesn't happen. And if what you do is you invest in a total stock market index fund that follows the market as a whole, you can get it from Vanguard, you can get it from Fidelity, very low cost, like 0.1% a year in costs, and then you can get on with the rest of your life and do the other kinds of jobs you do, and you are going to, over the long term, you are going to outperform all these other mutual funds or stock pickers or everybody else who's trying to beat the market. And you don't have to think about it. You simplify your life, and you don't have to think about it and worry about it every minute.
I love it. Yes. So index funds, I'm a big believer as well as index funds. So interestingly enough, since you brought up index funds, this is something that a lot of people do not understand, and everybody listening really needs to go and find out about index funds. And in her latest book, Jane Bryant Quinn talks about how to make your money last, the indispensable retirement guide. And in there, she does talk about index funds. And here's the deal. With index funds, I love what you said. It simplifies your life. It typically matches the market, and you have a much better chance of winning, if you will. Trying to beat the market any other way is ludicrous. Most people don't do it. Even the professional people who do this 24/7 can't beat the market. So I love the index market, index funds. I mean, there's one that Spider is pretty common one. There's a bunch of them. But the other thing that I like to do, the only other thing that I buy, is I follow Warren Buffett.
Yep.
And so I Warren Buffett still owns a bunch of Coke, and so I have invested in Coke singularly, only because in Coke does pay a dividends and stuff like that. So I kind of watch Warren Buffett, and if I can do some of the stuff that he does, I'll do it. But index funds by far is the most consistent, simplest way to make your money grow.
And it's very low cost, and when you cut your costs, that's the other way of making your money grow. Because that's money in your pocket, it's not money in an advisor's pocket.
Yeah, talk about this a little bit, because a lot of people do not understand the fact that they are spending so much money on these hidden costs that sometimes their gain is actually, what do you call it? Their gain will sometimes disappear because they're paying so much in these fees.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, of course, some of the worst fees, as far as I'm concerned, come in these variable annuity products that get sold.
Yes.
You know, some of them are you're paying, and you don't realize it because all these fees are hidden, you're paying 3.5% a year in fees. And when you look at what bonds are paying, for example, and you look at what stocks have paid over the past X years, and you're paying 3.5% in fees, what do you think you're getting left over? I mean, you're getting nothing, and you don't realize it. You have no idea how these people are just gobbling up your money, and you don't have to. And anything, non-traded real estate investment trusts, these variable annuities, anything that somebody comes to you and says, this is a fabulous, I'm the vice president of this big investment firm, and I can really help you out, and you're going to get this great return, and you can be sure that he or she is charging, is getting a really big commission out of that, and it eats up your long-term returns, and often you don't even realize it.
Yes, yes. And here's the, to me, this is the shame of it. A lot of these people get paid every time you buy and every time you sell. So you can lose a bunch of money. They're still going to get a commission.
Yep. That's right.
You know,
and
so,
whereas
so,
if you do these mutual funds where you're paying these just infinitesimal fees and you just put money in regularly and sit back and forget about it, you are going to do extremely well and you haven't wasted a lot of money in fees.
Yes. And 3% doesn't sound like a lot of money, but some years when you're only making 5 or 6% on your money, 3% is a lot. And then over the course of the lifetime of your investment, that 3% ends up being a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Huge, huge amounts of money, and it just vanishes into the maw of Wall Street. I'm a huge believer in people figuring this out and calling these mutual funds, doing things themselves that are simple, low-cost funds. Because, do you know, they've done all these studies on mutual funds. Morningstar's done a ton of them. Every year they do studies because they all try to predict which mutual funds are going to be better than other mutual funds. And year after year they come up with exactly the same result. The only predictor of long-term returns is cost. The lower the cost, the better you're going to do over the long term. There is no other way. You can look at who the manager was. You can look at the history for 5 years. You can look at all other kinds of things. Only cost is a predictor that works year after year after year. Low cost.
Yes. And the other thing about all these different reports is that they can be slanted in such a way where, you know, they look like maybe a mutual fund did well, but they're not calculating in all the fees. And so they can be misleading, or they'll do an average weighted return for a period of 4 months or something crazy like that. And it looks good.
Yeah.
But you have to really read the details to find out how they came to these calculations. And let me tell you, it's exhausting. So I love this idea of just doing it simple. Index funds, guys, check it out. They're low cost. They typically do as well as the market, if not better. I guess they don't do better, but they typically
do better than mutual funds. Again, there are some expensive index funds, Bert, you know. So they do as well as the market minus fees. So you want an index fund, an index ETF that follows the market as a whole and has a very low fee. And that, do you know, that plus living on less than you earn and saving the max, you know, you do that, everything else is ruffled.
I love it. I love it. Let's talk about this real quick, Jane. How does someone figure out whether they can afford to retire?
That's where you have to back into what your expenses are. You look ahead and you say, what income am I going to have? And you can find out what income you're likely to have from Social Security. If you have a pension, God willing, your pension stays. What income you might have from a pension. And then you look at how much money you've saved, and just as a first cut, take 4% of all the money you've saved, the value of your stocks, your bonds, your cash, whatever you've got. Take 4% of that and say, that is going to be what I have to live on. And then you look at what your expenses are. And if you're living a whole lot higher than that, you say, well, you know, I can't live on what this simple calculation tells me income I'm going to have. So my choices are to downsize, to live on less, or my other choice is to work longer and save more money. But that's the kind
sure.
of calculation. And again, I've got this in the book, you know, the steps you go through to do this kind of calculation. But people usually say, how much money am I going to need? And they do their budget and say, oh, I'm going to need X amount of money. That's backward. What you do is you say, how much income am I going to have when I retire? And then you have to figure out how to live on that.
Okay, so why did you choose 4%? It seems like such a low figure.
Well, 4% is actually, in a way, it's a conservative figure. It's the gold standard in, or has been for a long time, in personal finance. A lot of studies have been done that if you are, say, 50-50 invested in stocks and bonds, or it also works for 60-40, and you take 4%, and the year you retire, you take 4%, and each subsequent year, you take that same dollar amount plus an increase for inflation. And if you mm-hmm. do that, the studies show that your money will last for 30 years, and even that worked even during the Depression. It worked during the great during the terrible time in the 1960s, 1970s, when the market was going nowhere, which was terrible for retired people at that time. High inflation, the great stagflation, it worked during that period. We haven't had a 30-year period yet since the year 2000, when the tech stock crashed. We've had 15 years, full years, and it has worked so far for those 15 years. So this 4% the year you retire plus inflation adjustments has become the gold standard to get you through the worst periods that we have seen so far in the United States in the stock and bond markets. Now, that's very conservative. And so if you were more flexible, you could go to 4.5%, you could go to 5% and say, well, you know, if it turns out I'm living in one of the world's worst periods, then I can cut back because I'm flexible on my spending. But if you say the odds are that I'm going to live in a better 30-year period, then you can go above 4%. But you kind of start with 4% when you're doing your budget so that you don't kid yourself about how much you need, how much money you're going to have when you retire.
Yes, I love it. I love it. And you know what? That to me is part of what do you call it? Smart investing is being conservative. We've talked about living not below your means, but way below your means. And so if you can live on 4%, you're set. If you can live on 3%, even better. So I love this. I love these strategies. And the book again is
How to Make Your Money Last.
How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. The author is Jane Bryant Quinn. Jane, thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to having you back again soon.
Sure enough, Bert. Nice talking to you.
All righty. Good stuff. Bye-bye. There from Jane Bryant Quinn. And the book, again, is How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. And I hope you guys enjoyed some of these tips. They're pretty easy to follow. They're not complicated. Index funds, EFTs, check them out. They're easy, they're cheaper than most, and they continually outperform everything else. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest is Dr. Lupe Rebecca Samaniego. And guess what? She has become one of our regular contributors. And Dr. Samaniego is a licensed clinical psychologist. But more importantly, she's a certified high-performance coach. And I guess what I should do is just read her intro because that'll make things easier. But I just wanted to kind of clue you in. We're going to be hearing from her on a regular basis. Again, she's an expert in human development, rational trauma, traumatic stress. Dr. Lupe Rebecca Samaniego is a licensed clinical psychologist and certified high-performance coach, twice best-selling author. Dr. Samaniego has recently co-authored the best-selling book, The Winning Way. The world's leading entrepreneurs, professionals, share how they are winning in life, business, and you can too. She wrote this with one of my dear friends, Brian Tracy, who I used to share the stage with, as well as other professionals. What's really nice about the support, what's really nice about this book and why you should support it is the royalties from this project are given to Entrepreneurs International Foundation, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to creating unique launch campaigns to raise money and awareness for charitable causes. For over three decades, Dr. Samaniego has inspired professionals to effectively transform their lives as a sought-after speaker, leader, mentor, and psychotherapist. She inspires individuals daily to create meaningful interpersonal connections, live with passion, and make a difference in their lives. Dr. Rebecca Samaniego, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Well, thank you so much. I just wanted to say it's relational trauma, not rational trauma, even though it feels rational to have trauma, but it is relational trauma.
Oh, yes. I apologize. It is.
It's okay.
Yes. Yeah. Makes a big difference.
Well, so it tells you that it's both, probably. I think you probably hit it right on. We feel that the symptoms we come and have are rational, but it gets expressed in a relational manner. That's really what happens.
That's funny. Yes, I'm glad you pointed that out. All right, let's talk about this, because here you are. You work with many leaders across different categories in the making of your clinical practice there. What two qualities do you see these individuals aspiring to develop?
You know, that's a great question. When I'll start by basically saying that where we want to get to and where people want to get to at the end, and it's not easy, it's hard, but with work they can learn this. And the reason I'll tell you later why it's hard, but basically two things that people really need to come in with and work on and focus on. One has to do with the desire to understand themselves and others. Having said that, the process that becomes difficult is what I term under receptivity. Being receptive in the here and now of what is happening with yourself, and being receptive to the here and now of what is happening in the here and now of your interactions in relation with others. That sounds so simple, but it's really, really hard. However, when you get there or in the process of getting there, it is so rewarding and exciting. It really pays off in many, many ways. It calms you down. It makes you a better coworker, a better boss, and even a better dad and mom. You know, leaders come in with so many expectations that people put on them. Sometimes they don't put them on themselves. Sometimes people that they work with put this on them, and it's the expectation that they have to be inspirational and they have to be all put together and they have to know how to challenge themselves and others. But, you know, they get in trouble because those expectations sometimes triggers off other processes that are very difficult to cope with. And what they aspire, and what I keep in mind, you know, sort of as an overarching umbrella issue, is we're working towards receptivity. And I say that word a lot when I coach people, being receptive, because when they start getting defensive and they start being triggered, it's very easy to get angry. It's very easy to get anxious, and then that takes over. But if they keep in mind that they want to and see the benefits, that when they put that into practice, it moves them forward. It's very gratifying for me to watch and to be part of, and it's very gratifying for them to put into practice.
Sure.
So those are the two
main
characteristics that I feel that we're trying to, you know, move forward and stay with, whether they're working with me, but also more importantly, when they're dealing with individuals that may be difficult to deal with in their leadership positions. And sometimes, you know, they take that home, and it's important to use that quality of receptivity when you hear your spouse's complaints, if you will, or when you hear your child asking or demanding something of you, it becomes really part of who they become. And it's exciting to see.
Let's talk about this for a second, because, again, you work with leaders, CEOs and C-suite individuals as well. What qualities, in your experience, make an exemplary leader?
Well, the quality that I really see a lot in people that are really getting to know themselves is that desire to know themselves and a desire to know others, a desire that comes from curiosity, having the courage to face themselves. You know, we're not all perfect ever.
Right.
We can get really discouraged and grumpy and dismissive and sometimes worse qualities. But just the courage to know that you can face that, and that the more you face it does go away if you have that curiosity of understanding then and working with that. And that turns into a even deeper quality that I call resilience, you know, that when there are setbacks, you don't just run away from those setbacks. When there are setbacks, I tell people, you know, what is your attachment style? Or I should really call it a strategy, because we all have different attachment strategies. And by that I mean how we attach to important people in our lives when we're little. There are four main areas that there's been a lot of research on. And all those areas are either secure, you know, you are either secure, you learn that your mom and dad are there and they help you stay calm when there's tremendous stress. And those kids end up growing up with a quality of secure attachment strategy within themselves. When there's a lot of stress, they end up feeling more secure rather than not secure. The other strategies are also what I call coping strategies, but they don't work as well as adults. They work well as kids. And those are the styles of avoidance. You know, you learn to avoid conflict because maybe there's too much conflict in your family, and it's better to be avoidant and stay away from people than to interact with people because you don't want to be squelched or humiliated or, you know, even more stressed out. Another attachment strategy is anxiety. You know, you just become an anxious individual, and it keeps you from feeling a whole lot of stress or rage that may be in the environment. And these are just examples. And another strategy that you learn as a child is being dismissive or detached style. And the problem with these styles is that they work as kids, but they don't work really well as adults. And if you're a leader and you take that style that's not secure into the work environment, you can imagine how you contribute then to conflict. Instead of being secure and feeling good about dealing with conflict and believing, you know, if you're secure, you believe that people are essentially good at heart and that people will work things out with you. If you're feeling insecure and feel any of the other styles, you feel the opposite. You feel that you better stay away from people, avoid people, dismiss people, because you're going to get even more attacked or more humiliated. And so those do not become very adaptive as adults. And sometimes leaders have grown up with these less adaptive strategies, and it gets them in trouble at work. So the goal, along with being able to have a sense of what I call resiliency and what we were just talking about in terms of really understanding yourself and being receptive in understanding yourself, you are coping with strategies that are difficult. And so instead, we work towards those strategies of developing a secure sense of attachment within yourself so that you can bring it into work.
I like that. Yes. You know, I like this idea of resiliency, and I also like this idea of getting to know yourself and having this self-confidence. You know, and I don't know if you can do this or not, but see if you can walk me through this. How does our brain evolve in these areas? I mean, what does brain science tell us about these processes of developing, like, you know, resilience or self-confidence or these adaptive strategies that you're talking about?
You know, I there's many, many ways to conceptualize this, and this whole area of neuroscience mm-hmm. that I really love and I'm really excited about. But in a very simple way, I try to tell people, you know, the front part of the brain is really deals with social interactions. It keeps us focused outwardly. It keeps us our brain directed. It tells us how we're experiencing social interactions. It's really devoted to social interactions and telling us what's going on between the two people that are, you know, how we're communicating. Are we being in tune to what this person is saying? That's the front part of the brain. And that goes along with being receptive to what goes on between two people in relation to one another, such as in a work environment. The back part of the brain developed as a way to help us really deal with our own selves. It's really concerned with us as individuals, such as away or separate from an interaction, such as how we're breathing, how we're sleeping, you know, how we keep ourselves regulated, you know, with anxiety. When we're anxious, do we get more anxious? You know, where are our triggers? But what does our body tells us about that? So when you're not sleeping well or not eating well or eating too much or not having a sense of internal rhythm, it really is dealing with that back of part of the brain that's really trying to regulate itself and not doing such a good job, probably because there's a lot of reality to feeling overwhelmed with the environment. But it has to do with you per se, separate from the other person, but also in relation to the other person. So why this is important is that when we then, as leaders, deal with important people in our lives, we really have to have those processes intact. You know, how are we being receptive to what this person is saying? Basically, how is my brain and my own self regulating what is being said to me? And then what is my brain, the back part of the brain, doing with that information? If it's making me more anxious and more stressed, what strategies am I using to be able to stay receptive but then keep myself calm? You know, because we can hear it and then stay focused. Or am I, then this is where attachment style or strategy gets in the way. You know, somebody's giving me negative feedback, and I am then, instead of regulating the back part of my brain, my autonomic system, you know, breathing deeply, staying calm, I'm resorting to my early attachment style of being dismissive and being detached. So I'm not very present. I'm not very focused on what this person is saying. And if anything, I'm trying to get away from them, so I may be using even two or three different not adaptive strategies of avoiding people, hoping the meeting's over soon so that I stay away from them, not, you know, not seeing them in the hall and going the other route, you know, because you don't want to deal with any conflict. And it really harms the other person, obviously, who may want to be interacting with you. Maybe they have a better strategy of attachment or coping strategy of dealing with themselves, and they want to relate to you, and you're staying away as a leader. So that, you know, those are the kinds of issues that people come in with that really have gotten them in trouble at work, and they want to turn it around. So that's how I think of the brain,
yes.
You know, in terms of what's in the here and now of the interpersonal interaction, and what is my body telling me? What is the back part of my brain doing to regulate what is happening in the here and now of the interaction, of the interpersonal interaction?
Sure, sure. No, you know what? So let me ask you this. What do you see that gets in the way of us or of high-performing, exemplary leadership? What do you see as the main stumbling block there?
I see it as, you know, everybody has different triggers. Triggers
sure.
are you know, what may bother you may not bother me. What may you know, sometimes I'm amazed at what bothers people, amazed in the
right.
sense that I don't get it, but I get it once I understand their history. But some common denominators that I really do see and have seen throughout years and years of practice are the sense that what is being said or what is being experienced feels very threatening, and in the person's mind, it feels very disrespectful. It could be something as simple as not looking at them directly, or it could be forgetting an appointment. You know, you assign a coworker and they don't show up, or maybe they forgot because their child was sick, or something more, you know, understandable, but they don't wait to understand. The person feels so threatened that then they cope with one of those strategies that are not helpful anymore. The sense that they are feeling or being treated unfairly, that is also a very common trigger for individuals. So these are deeper issues. You know, they may come in and they say, I just have a lot of anger issues. Well, that may be true because they express their anger overtly, but what we find out is that underneath the anger, it's really the way they have coped with the triggers that are deeper, such as, you know, I got angry because I really felt unappreciated, or I really got angry because I felt not heard and there was a meeting and no one was listening to me, and I felt that the meeting was out of control. Or I assigned someone to work on a team, and they ended up working in another team, and so I got enraged. But it was really the sense of I wasn't heard, I wasn't listened to. These are common triggers and examples of what's underneath a particular kind of manifestation of disappointment, such as anger. There are other emotions.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, so I want to back up a little bit and talk about that. It's interesting, and I want to emphasize this, that what triggers me doesn't necessarily trigger you, right?
Yeah.
And so we see these, I think it's very easy when you look at different cultures to see this. You know,
yes.
I think that in some cultures, looking somebody in the eyes is a sign of respect. In another culture, looking somebody in the eyes is a sign of disrespect.
Yes.
And so all of a sudden, you could see if you got one culture that says looking directly in the eye is a form of showing respect, interacting with a culture that says looking me in the eyes is a sign of disrespect, they're not going to get along until they
right.
understand each other.
Right. Exactly. And I think that goes under the sense of, you know, that awareness and desire to get to know the other person. And if you see this person looking, you know, checking in, sometimes we say a lot with our bodies and with our frowns
yeah.
or our, you know, we may all of a sudden be joyful and then all of a sudden it changes into like almost a deadened look. Being perceptive of that is very important. Not that you would say that out loud, but you could say, you know, maybe I said something right now, or maybe I'm looking, you know, I'm from a different culture. I'm very aware that, you know, I'm from Venus and you're from Mars, sort of kind of thing. You know, we're from two different cultures. I just
right.
advertised somebody else's book, which is fine. I tend to like that book. But that it's the sense that we're different, and that's okay. And it's okay to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
It's okay to say, I don't get it. You know, I just know something just happened because we were laughing, and all of a sudden we both got so quiet, and I got so anxious because you look a little quiet to me, and I don't know, did I hurt your feelings, or did I say something that I was culturally not attuned to? You know, I think that would
right.
be what would be helpful more than anything.
Well, you know what, and I think that everybody's probably – had that experience where something is said specifically you or in my case I might say something and all of a sudden there's an awkward feeling in the air.
Yes.
And you can
yes.
tell that comment wasn't received correctly, and
yes.
instead of walking away or letting that comment hang in the air, that is a time that you need to say exactly what you're talking about. Hey,
yes.
I want to clarify what I meant by that comment because it feels awkward to me or it feels like though we've lost some energy. I want to make sure that everybody understands that, you know, this is what I meant and whatever, whatever,
yes.
because
yes.
that way it brings back the energy to the room.
Yes, exactly. I like that word energy. You know, sometimes we don't even have to say so much. Just focus on the energy. You can just say,
yeah.
whoa, it sure got quiet here. And that yep. what it goes under validating. You're just validating that something happened. And then if you people sometimes laugh awkwardly or, you know, they might just, you know, if it's a heated argument, somebody would just jump in. But it's validating and not avoiding that something just transpired in the here and now that gets in the way of moving forward. And I think leaders can do that so nicely if they are receptive to allowing it to happen. They can really, you know, be the leader, if you will. They can really lead by through example, by saying, you know, I don't even get it. Something happened here. You know, we all got, it got a little cold or it got a little quiet or, and, you know, not to point fingers at anyone, but I think it breaks the ice. So validation
yes.
of emotions and feelings and patterns is critical to move people forward in their journey to really get themselves to become a better leader.
Let's talk about this real quick. For individuals who are listening on the show right now, what would you tell them? What could they do to start the process of becoming a high-performing, exemplary type leader? What would you say to them?
I would say start with receptivity. You're going to want to do that. You're going to want to know yourself, even though it's hard to face yourself. You know, it's like a mirror. But that receptivity, you're going to say, I need to drop the blame and start being receptive. I'm not going to understand anything by just putting blame out there. Not even blame at myself. Some people are really, really hard on themselves, and everything is about
right.
themselves. I think drop the blame and validate that you are wanting to do this, being receptive. Stay curious about yourself. Stay curious about your coworkers, both in an interpersonal way, but also in a more deeper, meaningful way. Like, you know, maybe they had something else going on, and let me figure out what really happened here. So be curious, not judgmental, about what happened. Notice patterns.
Oh, I like that so much. Be curious, not judgmental. What a difference.
Yes. Be curious, not judgmental. And sometimes I tell people, drop the content, because they can come in and negative, negative, and this person negative, 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 and this person negative, negative. And I want to say, I want to do some. First, I do it gently. It depends on the person. But I can say, you know, I want to
right.
tell you something that's going to be very meaningful for you. And they go, negative, negative, but I have to tell you about negative, negative. And I go, drop the content. And that surprises them. Drop it. If you dropped it, what would happen between us right now? What would you talk about? So in that way, they have to do that when they start doing it on their own. You know, somebody disappointed them or disrespected them or they felt threatened is really the issue. Drop the content and get curious about what happened and how you can move that forward and not be judgmental.
I love it. I love it. You know, we're going to end on that note.
Oh, that sounds great.
I look forward to our next time together. This is such an amazing insight. The book again is The Winning Way. And what is your website in case somebody wants to reach out?
It's www.drsamaniego.com. So Samaniego is Samaniego.com.
All right, Dr. Samaniego, thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to having you back again soon.
Thank you so much, and glad to be here.
All righty, good stuff there on how you can be a better leader and really help individuals become a high-performing individual. And I love this idea of being curious over being judgmental. What a difference, what a shift in focus, and how would that affect your life if you became more curious versus more judgmental? Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.